Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At 137 pounds, the Oxford English Dictionary spans 20 volumes and 59 million words. At 155 pounds, our slender guest today, Amon Shea, has read every last one of them, nearly his weight in OED entries. That's like reading a John Grisham novel a day for a year. And, says Shea, every bit as page-turning. This hour on Point, we're reading the OED with author Amon Shea, sailing far and wide on the ocean of the English language. Joining us this hour from New York is Amon Shea, author of the new book, Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. Amon Shea, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. I'm delighted to be here.
This was so much fun. I just didn't want it to stop. Help us with these right off the bat. Agnestis and petrichor. I love them both. Definitions, please, sir.
Oh, great. Agnestis is defined as the point on an animal's back between its shoulders and its loins. It's the point it can't scratch. And although I think it's typically applied to animals or quadrupeds, I find it irresistible to apply it to myself as that point where I just can't quite reach.
Michael Phelps may be able to scratch anywhere on his back, but most dogs and cats and people cannot. And
right.
That's the spot.
I rub up against the doorway myself. But I like to think of it then metaphorically as well. That there's always some agnestis somewhere in my mind, some point that I can't quite reach to scratch.
Yeah, and petrichor. I loved this word. What a wonderful thing. Let's hear it.
It's really a delightful word, and it's one of those words that I find that people frequently say when they hear, "Oh, I always knew there was a word for that." And it's the kind of pleasant loamy smell that rises off the ground, particularly pavement after it first rains.
Who doesn't know that loamy smell of fresh rain on the ground? Fantastic.
Yeah, it's such a delightful concept to have.
I have to say the thing I loved above all in here, there's so many weird and crazy and wonderful words that you found, and it's quite an experience you had in getting to them through all these pages. But the fact that our language pulls up these tremendous nuances that we all know about, but we've forgotten there are words for them, and the words somehow bring that very narrow but delicious experience to mind of smelling that pleasant, loamy smell on the ground after a fresh rain.
Yeah, it really is one of the delightful aspects of English. And in a way, it's not even the words so much that I found so enjoyable. It's the concepts that they describe. And for instance, you know, a word like apricity, which it's really not ever been in common usage. I believe it was only the OED found it in one dictionary from the early 17th century. And apricity describes the warmth of the sun in wintertime.
Mm. And that sort of pale, light, but distinct warmth, different from summer warmth.
Right. This is a word that I sincerely hope I will never work into general conversation. And if I do, I sincerely hope that whoever I'm talking to will poke me in the eye for using it. I'm not a fan of using big words for their own sake. However, I do find now that in the summertime, when I am, you know, say, bathed in that warmth of the winter sun, I am more cognizant of the fact that it's happening, knowing that there is a word with which to describe it.
You say it's kind of dangerous to become too familiar with these words, because if you use them with friends or at the workplace, I mean, a lot of these are for your own satisfaction, not necessarily for weaving petrichor and prind and vocabulary into your everyday conversation.
I think most of these words that are unfamiliar are probably unfamiliar for a reason. And I'm not myself an advocate of bringing back a word that died a natural death, or a word which has largely disappeared. I do, however, appreciate them as curios of the language. I think they're delightful for their own sake.
This mountain range of the Oxford English Dictionary, in all of its girth and weight and length and deep volume, is one that an awful lot of people never attempt to climb. I mean, you got or had a dictionary at home. Not everyone does today. Dictionary.com or a thousand other ways to do it. But describe the beast for us, the sort of dimensions of it and what it does. It's not just like the little collegiate Webster's that most people have somewhere, maybe dusty, on the shelf.
Well, first of all, I would never say anything bad about the collegiate Webster's.
No, it's just different.
I know that you're not. It is itself a delightful dictionary, which holds an enormous quantity of information.
And you should know, you're a collector. You've got 1,000 or so on your shelves at home, I read.
1,000 volumes, which is in some cases different than an actual
of dictionaries, glossaries.
Yeah, they just add up. And I would also like to stipulate that I do not myself speak for Oxford. I'm purely an enthusiast. I know
fair,
I don't work for
enough.
Them, and I'm certainly not a historian of them. My understanding is, you know, one of the many reasons why the Oxford English Dictionary is so much larger than any other dictionary of our language, mm-hmm. Is that they treat the language much more in a kind of comprehensive fashion. They do not take words out because they are simply not used anymore. And they also do a phenomenally wonderful job of illustrating how these words have been used. So rather than just provide a word, its etymology and definition, they also provide examples of how the word has been used throughout the ages by various writers. So, for instance, I believe there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 33,000 quotations from Shakespeare, which means that in the OED. So that means that you're reading Hamlet, you know, front to back, back to front, top to bottom, sideways, on every possible angle. So there's a huge amount of literature that's kind of encapsulated in this book. It's been thrown into a sort of madcap blender and then spat out onto the page, but it still is all there. So, you know, if a word has been around for a particularly long time, say 1,000 years, they're going to provide examples throughout those thousands of years of how it's been used. And this takes up a considerable number of pages.
And that's where Shakespeare and everybody else, maybe Beowulf, come in, the sort of text that illustrates the usage.
Yeah, which is part of what also makes it such a kind of wonderful read.
To simply describe the OED as large, you write, is akin to saying that the bubonic plague was unpleasant. What did it mean to get through this in the space of a year? Did you really read all those 59 million words? And
what did it cost your health? Well, not as much as you might think, and it's considerably more enjoyable than it might seem. I think, like many people who enjoy reading books, I have this feeling of what I call this kind of incipient sadness when I realize that a book is, coming to an end, when I see the inexorable draw of the
yes.
pages.
Is there a word for that, that incipient sadness?
There is
coming to the
word,
end of a book?
I think it's finifugal, which means shunning the end of anything.
Okay. Finifugal. I love it.
I think that's the word. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me on that I'll get back to you on that. And shunning the end of anything, I don't think it's usually applied to books. But I've always had that feeling with a book when I realize that it will soon be over. So to me, it seemed to be a kind of logical next step to want to read a longer book and thus delay that incipient feeling of sadness.
I don't want to cast even an adubitation on that finifugal. Even a suggestion of doubt on your finifugal. I want to hear much more about your relationship with dictionaries and the way you got into this, but I'd also just want to start to roll some of these words out. I mean, what you've done in the book is describe your sort of odyssey through the OED, and you've brought us some of the sort of jewels or favorite words that you found in there. And start us with some of your A's here. I love assy. It's not what it sounds like, but ASSY, say a delightful four-letter word that has nothing to do with the caboose. Assy is what?
It just means asinine. It's a nice four-letter way of saying a slightly longer word.
Tell us about some of these others. Is it asimus? Acimus? You don't do pronouncers here, I noticed. But you should say,
I do not do pronunciations for the simple reason that in most cases, the OED doesn't give a pronunciation guide to a word that has not been pronounced in hundreds of years, I guess.
Since they never kick anything out, they're all going to be there. What do you make of this one?
It's an insincere desire, an insincere refusal of something that you actually want, which I believe is a kind of rhetorical term.
So we all know that the sort of, oh, no, I couldn't, I really couldn't take that.
Right. Yeah, A was a kind of wonderful letter for a lot of these concepts. For instance, avidulous, which means, I believe they describe it as somewhat greedy.
not real greedy, just somewhat
greedy. Not terribly greedy, but just it's what I like to think of as acceptably greedy, even though the OED certainly does not define it as such.
But abluvian, I loved that one. Things that are washed away, bathwater or anything else.
Yeah.
And advesperate, to approach evening. I mean,
right. Now, that's one of those great words that, as I said before, you know, I don't think I'll ever use it in conversation, but it does come to mind frequently when it is turning to dusk, you know, that I will think of a word like advesperate. So I find that I'm more conscious of it.
You've got abluvian and adubitation and advesperate. And, you know, I was thinking how in the movies, these are words that are put in the mouths of a top-hatted snake oil salesman or scammers in spats, you know, to sort of overawe and befuddle regular folk. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly would serve that purpose, I guess.
To put out a bunch of persiflage, and yet you've chosen many in here that have such a delightful, delicious nuance in them. In a way, whoever made these up, whoever created these words is saving experiences for us.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, one of the things that's also kind of phenomenal about the language is how specific it can be. I kept notes as I read because I would just write down everything that I thought was even remotely interesting. I knew I would want to come back to it mm-hmm. later. And I found time and time again that there would be these words which were, you know, they just worked so well together. For instance, antipelagic, which is referring to or antipelagy, which is refers to the love that children have for their parents. And then on the flip side of that, there's storge or philostorge, which is the love that parents have for their children. I have not yet seen any word for the annoyance that either party feels for the other, but I'm sure that it should exist even if it doesn't.
Must be.
There are words, however, there are great old Scottish words like father better, which means the state of being better than your father, and then there's father war, which means the state of being worse than your father. So the language really covers its bases marvelously most times.
Let's take a call from Montpelier, Vermont, and Janos. Janos, you're on the air with Ammon Shea.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ammon. Can you hear me?
Hi, yes, loud and clear, sir.
Well, ever since the fifth grade, Ms. Krauser, my teacher, said that when you come upon a word that you don't understand, don't go any further, go look it up. And I've done that ever since. And there's a company, Franklin Books, that puts out Merriam-Webster's Concise Encyclopedia, Dictionary, and Thesaurus, and they're about the size of a wallet, and I carry them with me now instead of 26 volumes, and brevity being the soul of wit, I just love to look up words and write letters, and I even use sealing wax. I guess that's just being old and fashion and romantic, but I think the art of writing and being succinct when you talk to someone is a lost art, and I really...
Passed a word, then, that you don't know the meaning of without looking up, has it made you a man of erudition or sound like a man of erudition? Do your friends say, oh, Janos, you really know how to work that tongue?
I don't try to talk up to people, but if I write to a certain... I suit the... As Shakespeare would say, I suit the action to the word and the word to the person. I don't throw $50 words at people that aren't going to understand it. But there is joy when I do find someone who is astute and erudite, and I can really have an epiphany of conversation.
It's wonderful. Janos, you've got the whole dictionary right in your hip pocket. It can't be the OED, of course. Not anyway. It's material bulk in that hip pocket. Ammon Shea, what about the way people use dictionaries? You hear how Janos does. What about the range of ways people approach the dictionary, whatever it may be, whichever?
I don't know. Yeah, it's one of the things about which I don't really have a platform that I'm trying to operate from here. But if I were to have a platform from which to, a soapbox to get on, it would be this, that I do think it's wonderful when you hear people talk about using the dictionary in that sense. And I think it's really a shame in a way how infrequently or how limited a range of uses we assign to the dictionary. There is so much wonderful information that's contained within pretty much any dictionary. You know, there may be a few that I can think of I wouldn't normally check, but mostly they're really just absolutely crammed full of all kinds of wonderful information, a lot of which is so infrequently looked for that I feel like it really is a shame. I don't necessarily say that everybody should sit down and read the dictionary from cover to cover, but I think that it's great to use it as a resource, but it's also great to use it when you don't need to use it. I too try to look up a word when I don't know what it means, but I found that one of the greatest joys of looking through the dictionary is to look up words that I do know or that I think I know.
Mm-hmm.
It never ceases to amaze me how often I'm in fact wrong about a word, or how often my knowledge is strikingly incomplete. You know, for instance, when I was reading through the OED and I came to the word secretary, and I discovered that the original meaning of it in English was one who is entrusted with a secret.
It's so obvious on the face of it, you know.
You know, I would never in a million years think, oh, I need to look up secretary. I don't know what it means.
Right.
And yet when I sat down and forced myself to actually read every word, whether I knew it or not, I you know, time and time again found things that I never would have come across before.
And it's much more than definitions, as you describe this year-long safari through the OED. I mean, you write that the Oxford English Dictionary, who would have thunk, gave you all the pleasures of a good narrative, sweep of emotions. How?
Well, you know, when you're coming across words with which you're unfamiliar, I found that, you know, when the definitions are so remarkable in themselves that they're incredibly evocative. For instance, there's a word like desiderium, which describes a thing which you no longer have but wish that you still did.
Oh, yeah.
I find it's impossible to read a word like that.
My baseball glove from when I was 10 years old. Where did that go?
Right. It just makes you think of those things. You know, you can't just look at it and say, oh, that's just an interesting word. It calls forth memory and emotion. Just as a great book would do the same thing.
Kind of related one, remored, you've got in here.
Right, love that as well.
It's to
remember with regret, or a slight touch of regret. You know, again, and this is a great word. It's impossible to read that word without thinking, at least for me, of something that I regret. So in that sense, it really is, it is like a work of literature. And,
I love it. Michael's calling from South Hadley, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for this. I'm really interested. I have a kind of pre-verbal toddler who's just playing with language now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in different words and different understandings of words, but also the understandings that words give us. And I notice you've said a couple times that having a word for something changes your experience of the world. It lets you appreciate something or notice something that you hadn't before.
Could do.
Having a sense of the scope mm-hmm. of the language over time, I'm wondering whether you notice things like that, whether you see a difference in people's understanding of the world reflected in their language.
Amen. We're looking for your distilled wisdom. but seriously, I mean, you're reading back here in context from centuries ago. What better prism than the language? It's the way we communicate what we see. Michael,
yeah,
he's got
yeah,
a pre-verbal
really
kid and
like...
wants to know. Did you sense the changing tides, the changing worldview over time in there?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I think that may be more of a question for the historical linguists among us than for me. I believe that there is some debate going on about whether or not the character of a people is reflected in their language or in the vocabulary. It's possible, but I think it's also possible that what you're seeing is the reflection of, you know, the people that catalog the language, the lexicographers that catalog the language. So I don't know if I would assign qualities to a time and a place or a people based on the vocabulary.
Patterns of the words that get lost versus those that remain, anything you can pull from that? in usage, that is? Mm-hmm.
Well, there are some unfortunate examples I can think of, but I don't know if they're necessarily FCC approved. So I don't know if I would pull them out of my hat at the moment. You know, it depends somewhat on some dictionaries. For instance, there was at one point I recalled when I was reading one of the Webster's dictionaries. So it seemed to be what to me was a really unconscionable number of words for. Preventing a dog from hunting by cutting out the balls of its feet. I think I came across six or seven words for that in Webster's Second. And they really seem to have much more to do with, you know, kind of English hunting practices at a specific time. But I don't know if I would say that's a reflection of the people and the time necessarily. I think it also may have been more a reflection of the lexicographers that put that particular work together.
And what about the notion that's, I think, commonly out there that we use less of the language in our day of high-speed communication and mass communication, that we have a diminished grasp on the English language? Does your tour through the OED tend to confirm that or something else?
I'm speaking strictly from a non-academic perspective. I don't know, but I would be hesitant to agree with that. I think I feel like it's kind of fashionable among many people to say what amounts to me. It's I feel like what they're saying is, oh, we were so much smarter in the days before universal education. You know, it seems that people like to say, oh, people used to write so much better, people used to speak so much better. I think it's possible, but I think it's that there were fewer people who were writing and that they were more noticeable. I find it hard to believe that, you know, if in a country of 300 million people, say 280 or 290 million of us are actually literate, that we are going to use fewer words than, say, if 20 million of us were literate, which is what the percentage may have been several hundred years ago, relatively speaking. Mm. I don't know. I think that maybe we are exposed to more examples of the language, and so it may feel like these examples are not quite as polished as they might be. But I don't know that I would say that I feel like, you know, some people like to always say that we're going to, you know, hell in a handbasket and the language is following close on our heels. But I don't know that I would necessarily agree with that.
We're going to hear in just a moment from one of the editors of the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary. But take us down through a few of these pairings of words that you took a shine to. Bayard, ignotism.
Bayard, I like I said, I try to not, you know, advocate that words which have died a natural death come back. But if I were to do so, I would recommend this word. A Bayard is a someone who has the self-confidence of the ignorant. And that's such a beautifully descriptive word, I think, that, you know, I'm sure everybody knows somebody who has the self-confidence of ignorance.
A few come to mind. Ignotism?
Yeah. Ignotism is just
the result of Bayard's at work.
All right. It's a mistake that is made due to ignorance. And that's an all too common event, I think.
You mentioned antipelargy, if that was it, the reciprocal love of children for the parents. What's storge? What's that?
Right. And storge is the reciprocal love that parents, I think, supposedly have for their offspring.
The instinctive affection.
That's how it was defined.
Yeah. I don't even know how to say this. Bouffage?
Bouffage is an enjoyable or satisfying meal. And, you know, one of the things I love to compare that to is grand manger, which is taken directly from the French, which is a great or a superb meal. So it's just so interesting that we have words not just for a good meal, but then we also have words for a great meal, although I have not yet come across the specific word for a terrible meal.
Could be out there. And then, of course, there's impluvious, wet with rain, and my favorite, petrichor, that loamy smell of rain on the ground. Let's turn to one of those editors who helps define what's in there and keep it up to date. Joining us from New York is Jesse Scheidlauer. He's editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary for the third edition of the OED. He's revised a whole lot of words, from American Big Apple, Indian jazz, prep, pretzel, punk, railroad, rap, even Republican. Jesse joins us from New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what exactly is your role here? You're an editor-at-large for the Oxford English Dictionary, sitting in the United States. What do you do for this great, grand collection of language and its context, Jesse?
Well, the main thing I do is revise the entries that are in that relate to America or Canada. The OED has never been revised before. It originally came out from the 1880s to the 1920s, and since then there have been several updates where there have been just new words published in separate volumes, but the core text of the dictionary is fundamentally unchanged. So if you look at any of these entries that have been part of the language for a long time, the odds are very good that the entry hasn't been touched for 100 years or so. And what we are doing now as part of the third edition, which is being published online, is going through the dictionary entry by entry, editing every single word and, you know, completely rewriting it. And that has been going on since 2000 when we began publishing online. And we are now a few letters into this. And what I do is work on the American entries as part of this process.
It's going online. Is that because, what, it's getting too big to actually publish? You'd have to have a spare room to house it? Or will it ultimately be between covers?
Well, there are several reasons. The main thing is that we can publish a new version, an update, every quarter, which we do online. And although there is a model for publishing this in print form, you publish in fascicles, which are small volumes, which is how the OED originally came out. So every 6 months or so, you publish a new thing. Nowadays, this is not really an effective way to publish. I mean, you can only get it in a library. You know, here we do it online. Everyone has access to it. And, you know, we get to correct things as we go. If we find new things as we go, we can put those in. We don't know if there will be another print edition of the OED. Many of us certainly hope so, and we are editing with an eye towards print. That is, we're not just throwing things in that we will then have to take out if we print it. But right now, if we're looking at 15 to 20 years before we complete the project, and the dictionary will be, instead of the 20 volumes that Ammon read, if it will be 40 volumes when we're finished, which is what it's looking like now, we simply can't say what the market will be for a 40-volume print dictionary in 20 years. Most people will want to look at this online. Right. And speaking for myself, I certainly hope that we do print it, but I think it's just too early to say.
Ammon read the whole thing. No one can help but stand in awe of it. But remind us of its mission. I mean, why is it that no word is ever, you know, culled out of the OED? Why do you keep everything in there, whether or not it's been used for... Well, first of all, what's it take to get in there? Is it just one guy, one time, Samuel Johnson burps a word and it's in there forever? And why does nothing ever leave?
Well, the main reason nothing leaves is that, as Ammon described, we are a historical dictionary. So the purpose is not just to illustrate the words that we use today. If that were the case, Ammon wouldn't have seen many of the fascinating words that he did come across, because these haven't been used for a long time or are not common. The OED shows the words that have ever been part of the language. So if you have something that hasn't been in use for 500 years, the fact that it was in use 500 years ago is still important. And if we take it out, then someone who's interested in the language of the 15th century, let's say, they can't find that. So once we make the decision to put a word in, it won't come out. It's part of the historical record being entered in the dictionary itself. People will need to look it up in the future. So even if something, if things change, you put in something and then technology moves on or people stop using it, it's still of interest that at this point in time, we judge that the word was important enough that it should go in. So when we make that decision for when to include a word, we have to do this very carefully with an eye to the fact that it will never come out. So we can't just put in something, the marketing people will love this if we put in this word, let's do this. Because 100 years from now, the marketing people won't like the fact that we have this weird thing in from 2008. So it's something that we have to look at very carefully when we're making that decision.
So when last we caught up with you in the press, you were looking at McMansion, Chowhound, and Jiggy. Did they all make it in? Will they be there forever?
Yes, those have all been entered. Those are in the dictionary. They will be there forever.
They'll be getting jiggy with it in the year 2525. Ken is calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Kenna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to comment that when I was in college, my logic teacher introduced us to the Oxford English Dictionary, and I never have ever seen a dictionary or read a dictionary like that. It completely changed the way I looked at words, and I would actually go to the library and spend hours looking up words that you think you know the meaning of, but when you look up their history, it was really actually, believe it or not, a thrilling dictionary. So there's no other dictionary, I think, that is like the OED, and if it wasn't so expensive, I would definitely purchase.
And what do you think, then, of Ammon's epic journey, Kenna? Can you imagine reading the whole thing and doing it in 12 months?
I know it sounds crazy, but I think it would be really a blast. I think it would be wonderful if I had the time to do that. I really do.
That's great. OED Odyssey Envy. There it is. Kenna, thank you very much for your call. There's so many that I loved in here. Curtain lecture you've got here from a Samuel Johnson entry. What's that? Curtain lecture?
That's a lecture that a wife gives to her husband in bed, I believe.
From the days when beds were often surrounded by curtains.
Right. You know, there are a great number of kind of interesting marriage words. There's a conjugalism, which is also defined as the art of making a good marriage. You know,
conjugalism, and we can say that on the air. That's great.
Conjugalism. Right? You can say that on the air. There are a number of words in here which describe things which you might not otherwise have a word to use on the air. And it's one of the many uses of the obscure words in the dictionary. Something I wanted to mention, though, when you were talking before about how, some words, disappear and some words, do we bring them back? But, petrichor, one of your favorite words,
yes,
is, in fact, a relatively recent word. I believe it was coined in 1964.
Wow. By whom, do you recall?
There were a couple of scientists who were working on a paper in which this particular smell was germane. So they came up with the word at that point, and it was put into a scientific paper, and it was then, I think, immediately used by several other kind of similar sources. And so it wasn't just a question of somebody made up a word and they stuck it in the dictionary. It did, in fact, meet the requisite criteria for inclusion. But you know, it does go to show that the language is, you know, obviously still growing and growing at a fine, healthy rate. Mm. So that some of these words are, in fact, old words which will never come back. But some words, I mean, 1964, that's a very, very young word. So it's entirely possible that it will, in fact, become part of the more general common parlance.
Jesse Scheidlauer, that raises a question I had as I went through here. There's many kinds of origins evident here, and I don't know all the languages that they came from by any means, but at certain points reading through, I felt like, well, an awful lot of these arcane or unused words are just kind of Latin jammed into English. There's mm-hmm. so many highly Latinate forms of English language in here. Is that a large percentage of the sort of backstock of OED words?
Well, when you look at the history of the language as reflected in dictionaries, you will tend to get a large proportion of that, which doesn't necessarily mean that that's what people use on a regular basis. In particular, many of these very esoteric Latinisms from the 17th century come because there was an interest in these terms called inkhorn terms back then, where people would write dictionaries just listing these very esoteric words, because at the time the thought was, well, you don't need to have the common words in the dictionary. Everyone mm-hmm. knows them. So you have a dictionary with all these incredibly abstruse words that, you know, have barely been used or have never been used or just made up. And it's very often hard to tell now, you know, if any of these had any currency or if it was just something that someone came up with. So if you're looking at, you know, that particular period of the language, or if you're looking at words that are hard to understand, many of them will indeed be, you know, from Latin or Greek. But on a regular basis, and so if you look at the dictionary on a percentage basis, yes, yeah, you know, Latin, Greek, French make up a pretty high proportion of borrowings. But if you look at the words that people most commonly use, you'll find that a very, very large proportion are Anglo-Saxon words or, you know, French, but with a much smaller proportion of Latin words in daily speech, let's say, or even common writing.
Here's one I loved. It's not consult, Ammon, but consult. Consult, to act stupidly together.
Right.
I wonder if anyone's ever opened a consultancy.
It would be nice. You know, there's a similar word, again, just which beautifully, you know, shows how closely related these words and concepts can be in English. There's consult, which means to act stupidly together, but there's also unassonous, which means being equal in stupidity. So they're both, you know, verbal and adjectival forms of a very similar concept.
And lots of ways at it, yeah.
Something that Jesse was saying just reminded me of something that I always thought was kind of funny, which is that, as he said, the original English dictionaries typically thought that they didn't need to, you know, define the common words because, you know, well, everybody knows what mm-hmm. they mean. And a wonderful example of that was Nathan Bailey, and he didn't write the first comprehensive English dictionary, but it was one of the earliest ones that attempted to kind of catalog the whole language. But even he, when he did so, when he came across a word, I think the example that was my favorite was cow. He defined it as an animal that is well known. So he's going to put the word in there, but he's still more or less saying, come on, you know, everybody right. knows what a cow is. You know, I don't really have to describe right. cow, do I? So he had a huge number of those kind of wonderful and useless, largely, inkhorn words in it as well.
Let's go to Ben in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a great show, and I've read a little bit about the OED. I was intrigued by the questioner from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, who
yes.
talked about how exhilarating it was to read it. I want to know comparison with other languages. Not many people can read this one dictionary. How about other nations' national dictionaries, and how do they compare with the OED? I'll take my question off the air.
Good. Ben, thanks. Jesse, how about it? French, Urdu, Tagalog, do they have OED equivalents?
French does. Urdu and Tagalog, as far as I know, don't. But there are very, very large historical dictionaries of many languages. German has one, Dutch has one, French has one. The Spanish Academy is working on one that they've been working on for, I think, 60 or 70 years and are still somewhere in the middle of the letter A. So these projects are very large and take a very long time. But there are projects like these for many languages. And you know, if there is a long history of a language, of course, you know, the longer the history is and the more writings there are, the more likely it is that you would be able to compile that if you have the time and the funding and the people who are willing to put the effort in, which is, you know, all of these are very difficult to come across, which is why these projects take as long as they do.
And I've got a question here from the website, onpointradio.org. This is from Keith. He says, I've heard that dictionaries have fake entries in them as a way to track when their pages have been copied in whole. Did your guest come across any of these entries, or is the story apocryphal? I'll ask you each, but Jesse, do you put in fakes to, I don't know, sniff out, you know, those who would copy?
The short answer is no. There has been one exception to my knowledge, which was an Oxford dictionary. My colleague Aaron McKean put in the word esquivalence, I think. I forget the definition, but that was put in as a fake word, and someone did, in fact, copy it. But there have – and this is in contrast, by the way, with maps where people do put in fake places with the intention of catching plagiarists. But there have been what are called ghost words that have made it into dictionaries, which were not put in intentionally for this purpose but ended up doing this. The most famous of these is the word dord, spelled D-O-R-D, which appeared for 7 years in Webster Second from 1934 onwards.
With what definition given?
The definition was physics or chemistry density. And the, what actually happened was that a definition slip was written D, that is capital D, or D, lowercase d, density, meaning that either capital D or lowercase d were abbreviations for density. And someone misread this as representing a single word, dord, lowercased it, added the physics and chem label, and put it in. And it took them 7 years to catch that, during which time it was absorbed into a few other dictionaries.
Ammon, in writing Reading the OED, you came up against this because, of course, you've not wanted to take your definitions right from the OED when you shared these, so you kind of had to come up with your own, or a paraphrase. Must have felt the temptation just to drop in their work.
And in certain cases, when their definition was just too good to pass up, I just credited them. Like, for instance, I believe they define be mute as to drop dung on from above, comma, as does a bird.
Which drop dung a, from above, be mute, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, right. And that just seems such a perfect New York City word that I couldn't come up with a possible better paraphrase the version of it. In large part, though, I was doing my best to convey the same meaning that they had without using the exact same words which they had used. Although I would say that in a number of cases, the OED does, in fact, define words by directly quoting a previous source. And it seems to me to mostly be when they are the only citations which they have found for a word come from a pre-existing dictionary, usually one which was several hundred years old. And they always credit the lexicographer, certainly. But at a certain point, I feel like there are only so many different ways in which you can say the same thing using different words. So, I would hew fairly close to what their version was.
I'm in the P's here. We've got patrizate, to take after one's father. And I had to go backwards then to look up and make sure. But yes, there is matricate, but it said to imitate one's mother. Is there a difference between taking after and imitating?
It's a good question. I don't know if there is or isn't. It's always a question, I guess, at some point when you realize that, a lot of these different letters were defined or were largely edited by different people. And there were the mm-hmm. four kind of main original editors of the Oxford English Dictionary, but then there have certainly been a number of other editors as time has gone along. I don't know if they have the exact same meaning, but they were just defined slightly different. It's a little difficult for me to say.
I loved peccability, capacity for sinning, the sort of opposite of impeccable is and pejorist, one who thinks the world is getting worse. Peristeronic, suggestive of pigeons. Right, I don't know when I would use that exactly.
Yeah, I don't know that you ever come up with a word which means suggesting a need for saying suggestive of pigeons, but it's a little irresistible, I found.
Yes, it is.
The fact that there is a word for that.
Let's go to Harry in Amherst, New York. Harry, you're on the air. Hello, Harry, are you there, my friend? Oh, let's get one from Newbury, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
I find this a terribly fascinating show. I grew up in a household where language was it. My father taught five of them, and dictionaries were all over. But one thing I would like to ask today is I came across a word many years ago in a dictionary, and I thought it was a wonderful word that meant to look at something longingly in the hopes that the person who had it would give it to you. And I now cannot find that word, so I was wondering if anyone could help me with that.
Sounds like a dead ringer for something that would be here. Ammon, Jesse?
Yeah, there is, in fact, a word for that.
Now you're on the spot. You've read the whole thing. 23,000 pages.
Yeah, it's. In fact, I don't even know that it's in the OED, but I have seen it in another. Is it not? It's not Grauk. Grok. That's it. G-R-O-A-K.
Grok to look longingly at something in the hope that its owner will give it to you.
Yeah, it's. I think it was typically applied to dogs, but that is in fact the word.
Oh, the dog looking at your dinner plate and wishing for a spare rib.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great. I love. Here's paleolatry, excessive reverence for that which is old. Pendiculation, the act of stretching and extending the limbs in tiredness or walking. Let's go to Jack in Winchester, Massachusetts. Jack, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've been an OED fan for many years. And in 1984, they came out with a T-shirt to celebrate the centennial of the first fascicle, A to Ant, I believe. And it had what was then the longest word in the dictionary, which at that time was floxy nossy nihili pilification.
And I'm wondering. You astound, sir.
Pardon me?
You astound. It's good.
No, it isn't to astound. It's to value things as useless. And the example sentence was, I loved him for nothing so much as his floxy nossy nihili pilification of money. it's a long story about where it comes from. I'm wondering if that's still the longest word in the dictionary, if you track such things. And another question I had is, I also have read, I think that the longest entry is for the word set. Is that actually true?
Set as in S-E-T?
Mm-hmm.
Jesse, can you shed any light here?
For the first question, floxinos and pilification is no longer the longest word. It was the longest word in the first edition of the OED, but in the second edition, it was supplanted by pneumonoultramicroscopic silical volcanoconiosis, which is allegedly the name for 45 letters, the name for a disease, a lung disease of coal miners. But in fact, it has been shown that this word was basically invented at a meeting of the National Puzzlers League in 1935 for the sole purpose of coming up with the longest word in the dictionary. And one of the interesting things about the original word, floxinos and nihilopilification, is that this word really has been used. So, there are contextual examples of people really using this, as opposed to just pneumonoultramicroscopic silical volcanoconiosis is an example of an extremely long word, which is the only way you'd ever come across it.
I'm lost in all those syllables. There was another part to Jack's question. Oh, dear.
Well, the longest entry.
Oh, yes.
Set. Was until very recently the longest entry, and I will let Ammon talk about that because I know he spent a lot of time on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, because we've been revising our way through, at the moment the longest entry is put because we started revising at M. We're currently publishing the beginning of R, so put has been revised and added to greatly. When we get back to set, when we get to run will become the longest, but then when we get to set will probably once again take over the position as longest one.
Ammon, help us. Why the shortest words with the longest definition?
First, before that, wasn't make briefly also the longest word?
I think make did.
So set has now been relegated to the third longest, which is a really kind of ignominious position in the dictionary.
Yeah, who cares?
I think it functions. It has a 155, currently in the print version, 155 different meanings as a verb, and 70-something as a noun, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There are just so many different ways in which it could possibly be used. And it's one of the great mysteries, but also one of the great tragedies of the dictionary, that the portions of it which take the most work by far on the behalf of the people who put it together, the lexicographers, are frequently the portions of it which receive the least attention. And I can only imagine it must be in some ways slightly aggravating to have to spend so much time on the portions which are going to receive such a dearth of attention from the users. That being said, though, I think it behooves all your listeners or readers who do enjoy the OED to go and take a look at this, if only for to give a little shiver of admiration for the people who have had to divide these senses. It's really a remarkable achievement, I think, to if you wanted to find pneumonoultramicroscopic silico volcanoconiosis, I mean, you find what it means. It means one thing, and that's it. It's really, it's great, but it's not that much of a part of
the entry
trick.
Doesn't go on that long. Not that many Shakespeare references to it, I suppose.
No. But, if you just sit down and try to think of all the different things that set can actually mean, you can really go mad. You can lose your mind trying to figure out what the differences are. It's a phenomenally difficult sort of thing to do.
Well, I loved the A to Z of this. Agatha Cockle mythological, made up of both good and evil. So many that resonate here. Zabernism, the misuse of military authority. Zugzwang, a disagreeable position in which a chess player is obliged to move but cannot do so without disadvantage. Ammon Shea, you are reading the OED's wonderful cliff notes to the great big thing, as you call it. Really delightful. Thank you very much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you. And Jesse Scheidlauer, editor-at-large of the OED, thank you for joining us in New York, Jesse.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad I could come.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.